"Will you go out with me?" he said, and waited for an answer. When the woman went quiet, he said, "See, this is why I need help. Now, to test this software, I think we require an actual person who wants to find out more about an actual potential romantic interest. Can I have a volunteer?"
Gus looked out to the audience, theatrically peering around with his hand shielding his eyes.
"No one? Oh, wait, I see a hand up."
To May's shock and horror, Gus was looking her way. More specifically, he was looking at Francis, whose hand was raised. And before she could say anything to him, Francis was out of his seat and headed up to the stage.
"Give this brave volunteer a round of applause,"
Gus said, and Francis jogged up the steps and was enveloped in the warm spotlight next to Gus. He had not looked back to May since he'd left her side.
"Now, what is your name, sir?"
"Francis Garaventa."
May thought she'd puke. What was happening? This isn't real, she said to herself. Was he really going to talk about her on stage? No, she assured herself. He's just helping a friend, and they'll do their demonstration using fake names.
"Now, Francis," Gus continued, "am I to assume you have someone you'd like to date?"
"Yes, Gus, that is correct."
May, dizzy and terrified, nonetheless couldn't help noticing that on stage, Francis was transformed, just as Gus had been. He was playing along, showing his teeth, acting shy, but doing so with great confidence.
"Is that person a real person?"
Gus asked.
"Of course," Francis said. "I no longer date imaginary people."
The crowd laughed heartily, and May's stomach dropped to her shoes. Oh, shit, she thought. Oh, shit.
"And her name?"
"Her name is May Holland,"
Francis said, and for the first time looked down to her. Her face was in her hands, her eyes peeking from under her trembling fingers. With an almost imperceptible tilt of his head, he seemed to register that May wasn't entirely comfortable with the proceedings thus far. But just as soon as he acknowledged her, he turned back to Gus, grinning like a game show host.
"Okay," Gus said, typing the name into his tablet. "May Holland."
In the search box, her name appeared in 3-foot letters on the screen.
"So Francis wants to go out with May, and he doesn't want to make an ass out of himself. What's one of the first things he needs to know? Anyone?"
"Allergies,"
someone yelled.
"Okay, allergies. I can search for that."
He clicked on an icon of a cat sneezing, and immediately a stanza appeared below. "Likely gluten allergy, definite horse allergy, mother has nut allergy, no other likely allergies."
"Okay, I can click on any one of these listings and find out more. Let's try the gluten one."
Gus clicked on the first line, revealing a more complex and dense scroll of links and text blocks.
"Now, as you can see, Love has searched everything May's ever posted. It's collated this information and analyzed it for relevance. Maybe May's mentioned gluten. Maybe she's bought or reviewed gluten-free products. This would indicate she's likely gluten allergic."
May wanted to leave the auditorium, but knew it would make more of a scene than staying.
"Now let's look at the horse one,"
Gus said, and clicked on the next listing.
"Here, we can make a more definite assertion, given it's found 3 instances of messages posted that directly say, for example, 'I'm allergic to horses.'" "So does that help you?"
Gus asked.
"It does," Francis said.
"I was about to take her to some stables to eat leavened bread,"
he mugged to the audience.
"Now I know."
The audience laughed, and Gus nodded as if to say, "Aren't we a pair?"
"Okay," Gus continued. "Now notice that the mentions of the horse allergy were way back in 2010, from Facebook of all places. For all of you who thought it was silly of us to pay what we did for Facebook's archives, take heed. Okay, no allergies, but check this out, right nearby. This is what I had in mind next. Food. Did you think you might take her out to eat, Francis?"
Francis answered, gamely.
"Yes, I did, Gus."
May didn't recognize this man on stage. Where had Francis gone? She wanted to kill this version of him.
"Okay, this is where things usually get ugly and stupid. There's nothing worse than the back and forth. Where do you want to eat? Oh, anything's fine. No, really, what's your preference? Doesn't matter to me. What's yours? No more of that bull shite."
Love breaks it down for you. Anytime she's posted, anytime she's liked or disliked a restaurant, anytime she's mentioned food, it all gets ranked and sorted, and I end up with a list like this.
He clicked on the food icon, which revealed a number of subset lists with rankings of type of food, names of restaurants, restaurants by city and by neighborhood. The lists were uncanny in their accuracy. They even featured the place she and Francis had eaten earlier that week.
Now I click on the place I like, and if she paid through TrueU, I know what she ordered last time she ate there. Click here and see the specials for those restaurants on Friday when our date will happen. Here's the average wait for a table that day. Uncertainty eliminated.
Gus went on and on throughout the presentation, into May's preferences for films, for outdoor spaces to walk on and jog through, to favorite sports, favorite vistas. It was accurate, most of it. And while Gus and Francis hammed it up on stage, and the audience grew ever more impressed with the software, May had first hidden behind her hands, then sunk to the lowest possible place in her seat, and finally, when she felt at any moment she'd be asked to get on stage to confirm the great power of this new tool, she slipped out of her seat, across the aisle, out the auditorium's side door, and into the flat white light of an overcast afternoon.
"I'm sorry." May couldn't look at him.
"May, sorry. I don't understand why you're so mad."
She did not want him near her. She was back at her desk, and he'd followed her there, standing over her like some carrion bird. She didn't glance at him because besides loathing him and finding his face weak and his eyes shifty, besides being sure she'd never need to see that wretched face again, she had work to do. The afternoon shoot had been opened, and the flow was heavy.
"We can talk later," she said to him, but she had no intention of talking to him again, that day or any day. There was relief in that certainty.
Eventually he left, at least his corporeal self left, but he appeared in minutes on her third screen, pleading for forgiveness. He told her he knew he shouldn't have sprung it on her, but that Gus had insisted on it being a surprise. He sent 40 or 50 messages throughout the afternoon, apologizing, telling her what a big hit she was, how it would have been even better if she'd gotten on stage because people were clapping for her. He assured her that everything that had been on screen was publicly available, none of it embarrassing, all of it culled from things she'd posted herself, after all. And May knew all this to be true. She wasn't angry at the revelation of her allergies or her favorite foods. She had openly offered this information for many years, and she felt that offering her preferences and reading about others was one of the things she loved about her life online. So what had mortified her during Gus's presentation? She couldn't put her finger on it. Was it only the surprise of it? Was it the pinpoint accuracy of the algorithms? Maybe. But then again, it wasn't entirely accurate, so was that the problem? Having a matrix of preferences presented as your essence, as the whole you, maybe that was it. It was some kind of mirror, but it was incomplete, distorted. And if Francis wanted any or all of that information, why couldn't he just ask her? Her third screen, though, all afternoon, was filled with congratulatory messages. "You're awesome, May. Good job, newbie. No horseback rides for you. Maybe a llama?" She pushed through the afternoon and didn't notice her blinking phone till after 5. She'd missed 3 messages from her mother. When she listened to them, they all said the same thing. "Come home." As she drove over the hills and through the tunnel, heading east, she called her mom and got the details. Her father had had a seizure, had gone to the hospital, was asked to spend the night for observation. May was told to drive directly there, but when she arrived, he was gone. She called her mother.
"Where is he?"
"Home. Sorry, we just got here. I didn't think you'd get out here so soon. He's fine."
So May drove home, and when she arrived, breathless and angry and scared, she saw Mercer's Toyota pickup in the driveway, and this sent her into a mental bramble. She didn't want him here. It complicated an already gory scene. She opened the door and saw not her parents, but Mercer's giant, shapeless form. He was standing in the foyer. Every time she saw him again after time apart, she was jarred by how big he was, how lumpy. His hair was longer now, adding to his mass. His head blocked all light.
"Heard your car," he said.
He had a pear in his hand.
"Why are you here?" she asked.
"They called me to help," he said.
"Dad?"
She rushed past Mercer and into the living room. There, her father was resting, lengthwise, on the couch, watching baseball on the television. He didn't turn his head, but looked her way.
Hey, hon. Heard you out there.
May sat on the coffee table and held his hand. You okay?
I am. Just a scare, really. It started strong, but petered out.
Almost imperceptibly, he was inching his head forward to see around her. Are you trying to watch the game?
Ninth inning, he said.
May moved out of the way. Her mother entered the room.
We called Mercer to help get your father into the car.
I didn't want the ambulance,
her father said, still watching the game.
So was it a seizure?
May asked.
They're not sure,
Mercer said from the kitchen.
Can I hear the answer from my own parents?
May called out.
Mercer was a lifesaver, her father said.
Why didn't you call me to say it wasn't so serious?
May asked.
It was serious, her mother said. That's when I called. But now he's watching baseball. It's not as serious now, her mother said, but for a while there, we really didn't know what was happening, so we called Mercer.
He saved my life.
I don't think Mercer saved your life, Dad.
I don't mean that I was dying, but you know how I hate the whole circus with the EMTs and the sirens and the neighbors knowing. We just called Mercer. He got here in 5 minutes, helped me get to the car, into the hospital, and that was that. It made all the difference.
May fumed. She'd driven 2 hours in a red panic to find her father relaxing on the couch, watching baseball. She'd driven 2 hours to find her ex in her home, anointed the hero of the family. And what was she? She was somehow negligent? She was superfluous. It reminded her of so many of the things she didn't like about Mercer. He liked to be considered kind, but he made sure everyone knew it, and that drove May mad, always having to hear about his kindness, his straight-upness, his reliability, his boundless empathy. But with her, he'd been diffident, moody, unavailable too many times she needed him.
You want some chicken? Mercer brought some, her mother said,
and May decided that was a good cue to use her bathroom for a few minutes, or 10.
I'm going to clean up, she said, and went upstairs.
Later, after they'd all eaten and recounted the day, explaining how her father's vision had diminished to an alarming state, and the numbness in his hands had worsened, symptoms the doctor said were normal and treatable, or at least addressable, and after her parents had gone to bed, May and Mercer sat in the backyard, the heat still coming off the grass, the trees, the rain-washed gray fences that surrounded them.
Thanks for helping, she said.
It was easy. Vinny's lighter than he used to be.
May didn't like the sound of that. She didn't want her father to be lighter, easily carried. She changed the subject.
How's business?
Really good. Really good. I actually had to take on an apprentice last week. Isn't that cool? I have an apprentice. And your job? Great?
May was taken aback. Mercer was rarely so ebullient.
It is great, she said.
Good. Good to hear. I was hoping it'd work out. So you're doing what? Programming or something?
I'm in CE, customer experience. I deal with the advertisers right now. Wait, I saw something about your stuff the other day. I looked you up and there was this comment about someone getting something shipped damaged. They were so pissed. I'm assuming you saw that.
Mercer exhaled theatrically. I didn't. His face had gone sour.
Don't worry, she said. It was just some nut job.
And now it's in my head.
Don't blame me. You just made me aware that there's some kook out there who hates me and wants to hurt my business. There were other comments, too, and most of them were nice. There was actually one really funny one.
She began scrolling through her phone.
May, please. I'm asking you not to read it.
Here it is. All those poor deer antlers died for this shit?
May, I ask you not to read me that.
What? It was funny.
How can I ask you not to do that in a way where you'll respect my wishes?
This was the Mercer May remembered and couldn't stand. Prickly, moody, high-handed.
What are you talking about?
Mercer took a deep breath, and May knew he was about to give a speech. If there was a podium before him, he'd be stepping up to it, removing his papers from his sport coat pocket. 2 years of community college, and he thought he was some kind of professor. He'd given her speeches about organically sourced beef, about the early work of King Crimson, and each time it started with this deep breath, a breath that said, "Settle in, this will take a while and will blow your mind." "May, I have to ask you to..." "I know, you want me to stop reading your customer comments. Fine." "No, that's not what I was..." "You want me to read them to you?" "May, how about if you just let me finish my sentence? Then you'll know what I'm saying. You guessing the end of every one of my sentences is never helpful because you're never right."
"But you talk so slow."
"I talk normally. You've just gotten impatient."
"Okay, go."
"But now you're hyperventilating."
"I guess I'm just so easily bored by this."
"By talking?"
"By talking in slow motion."
"Can I start now? It'll take 3 minutes. Can you give me 3 minutes, May?"
"Fine."
"3 minutes where you won't know what I'm about to say, okay? It will be a surprise."
"Okay."
"All right." "May? We have to change how we interact. Every time I see or hear from you, it's through this filter. You send me links, you quote someone talking about me, you say you saw a picture of me on someone's wall. It's always this third-party assault. Even when I'm talking to you face-to-face, you're telling me what some stranger thinks of me. It becomes like we're never alone. Every time I see you, there's 100 other people in the room. You're always looking at me through 100 other people's eyes."
"Don't get dramatic about it."
"I just want to talk with you directly, without you bringing in every other stranger in the world who might have an opinion about me."
"I don't do that."
"You do, May. A few months ago, you read something about me, and remember this? When I saw you, you were so standoffish. That's because they said you were using endangered species for your work."
"But I've never done that."
"Well, how am I supposed to know that?" "You can ask me. Actually ask me. You know how weird that is? That you, my friend and ex-girlfriend, gets her information about me from some random person who's never met me? And then I have to sit across from you and it's like we're looking at each other through this strange fog."
"Fine. Sorry.
Will you promise me to stop doing this?"
"Stop reading online?"
"I don't care what you read, but when you and I communicate, I want to do it directly. You write to me, I write to you. You ask me questions, and I answer them. You stop getting news about me from third parties."
"But Mercer, you run a business. You need to participate online. These are your customers, and this is how they express themselves, and how you know if you're succeeding."
May's mind churned through a half-dozen circle tools she knew would help his business, but Mercer was an underachiever who somehow managed to be smug about it. "See, that's not true, May. It's not true. I know I'm successful if I sell chandeliers. If people order them, then I make them, and they pay me money for them. If they have something to say afterward, they can call me or write me. I mean, all this stuff you're involved in, it's all gossip. It's people talking about each other behind their backs. That's the vast majority of this social media, all these reviews, all these comments. Your tools have elevated gossip, hearsay, and conjecture to the level of valid mainstream communication. And besides that, it's fucking dorky."
May exhaled through her nostrils.
"I love it when you do that," he said. "Does that mean you have no answer? Listen, 20 years ago, it wasn't so cool to have a calculator watch, right? And spending all day inside playing with your calculator watch sent a clear message that you weren't doing so well socially, and judgments like and dislike and smiles and frowns were limited to junior high. Someone would write a note, and it would say, 'Do you like unicorns and stickers?' And you'd say, 'Yeah, I like unicorns and stickers. Smile.' That kind of thing. But now, it's not just junior high kids who do it. It's everyone. And it seems to me sometimes I've entered some inverted zone, some mirror world where the dorkiest shit in the world is completely dominant. The world has dorkified itself."
"Mercer, is it important to you to be cool?"
"Do I look like it is?"
He passed a hand over his expanding stomach, his torn fatigues.
"Clearly, I'm no master of cool, but I remember when you'd see John Wayne or Steve McQueen, and you'd say, 'Wow, those guys are badass. They ride horses and motorcycles and wander the earth righting wrongs.'"
May couldn't help but laugh. She saw the time on her phone. "It's been more than 3 minutes."
Mercer plowed on. Now the movie stars beg people to follow their Zing feeds. They send pleading messages asking everyone to smile at them. And holy fuck, the mailing lists? Everyone's a junk mailer. You know how I spend an hour every day thinking of ways to unsubscribe to mailing lists without hurting anyone's feelings? There's this new neediness. It pervades everything. He sighed as if he'd made some very important points. It's just a very different planet.
It's different in a good way, May said. There are a thousand ways it's better, and I can list them, but I can't help it if you're not social. I mean, your social needs are so minimal. It's not that I'm not social. I'm social enough, but the tools you guys create actually manufacture unnaturally extreme social needs. No one needs the level of contact you're purveying. It improves nothing. It's not nourishing. It's like snack food. You know how they engineer this food? They scientifically determine precisely how much salt and fat they need to include to keep you eating. You're not hungry. You don't need the food. It does nothing for you, but you keep eating these empty calories. This is what you're pushing. Same thing. Endless empty calories, but the digital social equivalent. And you calibrate it so it's equally addictive.
Oh, Jesus. You know how you finish a bag of chips and you hate yourself? You know you've done nothing good for yourself? That's the same feeling. And you know it is, after some digital binge. You feel wasted and hollow and diminished.
I never feel diminished.
May thought of the petition she'd signed that day to demand more job opportunities for immigrants living in the suburbs of Paris. It was energizing and would have impact. But Mercer didn't know about this, or anything May did, anything the Circle did, and she was too sick of him to explain it all. And it's eliminated my ability to just talk to you. He was still talking. I mean, I can't send you emails because you immediately forward them to someone else. I can't send you a photo because you post it on your own profile. And meanwhile, your company is scanning all of our messages for information they can monetize. Don't you think this is insane? May looked at his fat face. He was thickening everywhere. He seemed to be developing jowls. Could a man of 25 already have jowls? No wonder snack food was on his mind.
Thanks for helping my dad, she said,
and went inside and waited for him to leave. It took him a few minutes to do so. He insisted on finishing his beer, but soon enough, he did. And May turned out the downstairs lights, went to her old room, and dropped herself into her bed. She checked her messages, found a few dozen that needed her attention, and then, because it was only 9 o'clock and her parents were already asleep, she logged onto her Circle account and handled a few dozen queries, feeling, with every fulfilled request, that she was cleaning the Mercer off of herself. By midnight, she felt reborn. On Saturday, May woke in her old bed, and after breakfast, she sat with her father, the two of them watching women's professional basketball, something he'd taken to doing with great enthusiasm. They wasted the rest of the day playing cards and running errands, and together cooked a chicken sauté dish her parents had learned at a cooking class they'd taken at the Y. On Sunday morning, the routine was the same. May slept in, feeling leaden and feeling good about it, and wandered into the TV room, where her father was again watching some WNBA game. This time he was wearing a thick white robe a friend of his had pilfered from a Los Angeles hotel. Her mother was outside, using duct tape to repair a plastic garbage can that raccoons had damaged while trying to extract its contents. May was feeling dull-witted, her body reluctant to do anything but recline. She had been, she realized, on constant alert for a full week, and hadn't slept more than 5 hours on any given night. Simply sitting in her parents' dim living room, watching this basketball game, which meant nothing to her, all those ponytails and braids leaping, all that squeaking of sneakers, was restorative and sublime.
"You think you can help me up, Sweet Pea?"
her father asked. His fists were deep in the couch, but he couldn't lift himself. The cushions were too deep. May got up and reached for his hand, but when she did, she heard a faint, liquid sound.
"Mother bastard,"
he said, and began to sit down again. Then he adjusted his trajectory and leaned on his side, as if he just remembered there was something fragile he couldn't sit on.
"Can you get your mother?"
he asked, his teeth clenched, his eyes closed. "What's wrong?" May asked. He opened his eyes, and there was an unfamiliar fury in them.
"Please just get your mother?"
I'm right here. Let me help, she said. She reached for his hand again. He swatted her away.
Get your mother!
And then the smell hit her. He'd soiled himself. He exhaled loudly, composing himself. Now with a softer voice, he said,
Please, please, dear, get Mom.
May ran to the front door. She found her mother by the garage and told her what had happened. May's mother did not rush inside. Instead, she held May's hands in her own. I think you better head back now, she said. He won't want you to see this.
I can help,
May said.
Please, honey. You have to grant him some dignity.
Bonnie!
His voice boomed from inside the house. May's mother grabbed her hand.
May, sweetie, just get your stuff and we'll see you in a few weeks, okay?
May drove back to the coast, her body shaking with rage. They had no right to do that, to summon her home and then cast her out. She didn't want to smell his shit. She would help, yes, any time she was asked, but not if they treated her that way. And Mercer, he was scolding her in her own house. Jesus Christ, the three of them. May had driven 2 hours there and now was driving two back. And what had she gotten for all this work? Just frustration. At night, lectures from fat men, and during the day, shooed away by her own parents. By the time she got back to the coast, it was 4:14. She had time, she thought. Did the place close at 5 or 6? She couldn't remember. She swerved off the highway and toward the marina. When she got to the beach, the gate to the kayak storage areas was open, but there was no one in sight. May looked around, between the rows of kayaks and paddles and life preservers.
Hello? She said.
Hello?
A voice said.
Over here in the trailer.
Behind the rows of equipment, there was a trailer on cinder blocks, and through the open door, May could see a man's feet on a desk, a phone cord stretching from a desk unit to an unseen face. She walked up the steps, and in the darkened trailer she saw a man, in his 30s, balding, holding his index finger up to her. May checked her phone for the time every few minutes, seeing the minutes slip away. 4:20, 4:21, 4:23. When he was off the phone, he smiled.
Thanks for your patience. How can I help?
Is Marion around?
No, I'm her son, Walt.
He stood and shook May's hand. He was tall, thin, sunburned.
Nice to meet you. Am I too late?
Too late for what? Dinner?
He said, thinking he'd made a joke.
To rent a kayak.
Oh. Well, what time is it? I haven't checked in a while.
She didn't have to check. 4:26, she said. He cleared his throat and smiled.
4:26, eh? Well, we usually close at 5, but seeing as you're so good with time, I bet I can trust you to bring it back at 5:22. You think that's fair? That's when I have to leave to pick up my daughter.
Thank you, May said.
Let's get you set up, he said. We just digitized our system. You said you have an account?
May gave him her name, and he typed it into a new tablet, but nothing registered. After 3 tries, he realized his Wi-Fi wasn't working.
Maybe I can check you in on my phone,
he said, taking it from his pocket. Can we do it when I come back? May asked, and he agreed, thinking it would give him time to bring the network back up. He set May up with a life preserver and kayak, and when she was out on the water, she checked her phone again. 4:32. She had almost an hour. On the bay, an hour was always plenty. An hour was a day. She paddled out, and this day saw no harbor seals in the marina, though she dawdled purposely to try to draw them out. She made her way over to the old half-sunken pier, where they sometimes sun themselves, but found none. There were no harbor seals, no sea lions. The pier was empty, a sole filthy pelican sitting atop a post. She paddled beyond the tidy yachts, beyond the mystery ships and into the open bay. Once there, she rested, feeling the water beneath her, smooth and undulating, like gelatin fathoms deep. As she sat, unmoving, a pair of heads appeared 20 yards in front of her. They were harbor seals and were looking at each other as if deciding whether they should look at May in unison, which they presently did. They stared at each other, the two seals and May, no one blinking until, as if realizing how uninteresting May was, just some figure unmoving, one seal leaned into a wave and disappeared, and the second seal quickly followed. Ahead, halfway into the bay, she saw something new, a man-made shape she hadn't noticed before, and decided that would be her task that day, to make her way to the shape and investigate. She paddled closer and saw that the shape was actually two vessels, an ancient fishing boat tethered to a small barge. On the barge, there was an elaborate but jerry-rigged sort of shelter. If this existed anywhere on land, especially around here, it would be dismantled immediately. It looked like pictures she'd seen of Hooverville or some makeshift refugee settlement. May was sitting, squinting at the mess of it, when, from under a blue tarpaulin, a woman emerged.
"Oh, hey," the woman said. "You came out of nowhere."
She was about 60, with long white hair, full and frayed, pulled into a ponytail. She took a few steps forward, and May saw that she was younger than she'd assumed, maybe early 50s, her hair streaked with blonde.
"Hi," May said. "Sorry if I'm getting too close. The people in the marina make a point of telling us not to disturb you guys out here."
"Usually that's the case," the woman said. "But seeing as we're coming out to have our evening cocktail," she said as she settled into a plastic white chair, "your timing is impeccable."
She craned her head back, speaking to the blue tarpaulin.
"You gonna hide in there?"
"Getting the drinks, lovebird,"
a male voice said, his form still invisible, his voice straining to be polite. The woman turned back to May. In the low light, her eyes were bright, a bit wicked.
"You seem harmless. You want to come aboard?"
She tilted her head, assessing May. May paddled closer, and when she did, the male voice emerged from under the tarpaulin and took on human form. He was leathery, a bit older than his companion, and he moved slowly, getting out of the boat and onto the barge. He was carrying what appeared to be two thermoses.
"Is she joining us?"
the man asked the woman, dropping himself into the matching plastic chair next to hers.
"I asked her to,"
the woman said. When May was close enough to make out their faces, she could see they were clean, tidy. She'd feared their clothing would confirm what their vessel implied, that they were not just waterborne vagabonds, but dangerous, too. For a moment, the couple watched as May maneuvered her way to their barge, curious about her, but passive, as if this was their living room and she their night's entertainment.
"Well, help her,"
the woman said testily, and the man stood. The bow of May's kayak knocked against the steel edge of the barge, and the man quickly tied a rope around it and pulled the kayak so it was parallel. He helped her up and onto the surface, a patchwork of wooden planks.
"Sit here, honey,"
the woman said, indicating the chair he'd vacated to help her. May sat down and caught the man giving the woman a wild look.
"Well, get another one,"
the woman said to him, and he disappeared again under the blue tarp.
"I don't usually boss him around so much," she said to May, reaching for one of the thermoses he'd set down. "But he doesn't know how to entertain. You want red or white?"
May had no reason to accept either in the middle of the afternoon, when she had the kayak to return and then the drive home, but she was thirsty. And if the wine was white, it would be so good under the afternoon's low sun, and quickly she decided she wanted some. "White, please," she said. A small red stool appeared from the folds of the tarpaulin, followed by the man, making a show of looking put out.
"Just sit and have a drink,"
the woman said to him, and into paper coffee cups she poured May's white and red for herself and her companion. The man sat. They all raised their glasses, and the wine, which May knew was not good, tasted extraordinary. The man was assessing May.
"So you're some kind of adventurer, I take it? Extreme sports and such?"
He drained his cup and reached for the thermos. May expected his mate to look at him disapprovingly, as her mother would have, but the woman's eyes were closed, facing the setting sun. May shook her head. No, not really at all.
We don't see that many kayakers out here,
he said, refilling his cup.
They tend to stay closer to shore.
I think she's a nice girl,
the woman said, her eyes still closed.
Look at her clothes. She's almost preppy. But she's no drone. She's a nice girl with occasional bursts of curiosity.
Now the man took the role of apologist.
Two sips of wine, and she thinks she's some fortune teller.
It's okay, May said, though she didn't know how she felt about the woman's diagnosis. As she looked at the man, and then at the woman's eyes opened.
There's a pod of gray whales heading up here tomorrow,
she said, and turned her eyes toward the Golden Gate. She narrowed them, as if completing a mental promise with the ocean that, when the whales arrived, they would be well treated. Then she closed her eyes again. Entertaining May seemed to be left to the man for now.
So how's the bay feel today?
He asked.
Good, May said. It's so calm.
Calmest it's been this week,
he agreed. And for a while no one spoke, as if the three of them were honoring the water's tranquility with a moment of silence. And in the silence, May thought about how Annie, or her parents, would react to seeing her out here, drinking wine in the afternoon on a barge, with strangers who lived on a barge. Mercer, she knew, would approve.
You see any harbor seals?
The man finally asked. May knew nothing about these people. They hadn't offered their names and hadn't asked May for hers. Far beyond, a foghorn sounded.
Just a few today, closer to shore, May said.
What do they look like?
The man asked, and when May described them, their gray glassine heads, the man glanced to the woman.
Stevie and Kevin?
The woman nodded in recognition.
I think the others are further out today, hunting. Stevie and Kevin don't leave this part of the bay too often. They come here all the time to say hello.
May wanted to ask these people if they lived here, or, if not, what exactly they were doing out here on this barge attached to that fishing boat, neither of which seemed functional in any way. Were they here for good? How did they get here in the first place? But asking any of these questions seemed impossible when they hadn't asked her name.
Were you here when that burned?
The man asked, pointing to a large uninhabited island in the middle of the bay. It rose, mute and black, behind them. May shook her head.
It burned for 2 days. We had just gotten here. At night, the heat, you could feel it even here. We swam every night in this godforsaken water just to stay cool. We thought the world was ending.
Now the woman's eyes opened, and she focused on May.
Have you swum in this bay? A few times,
May said. It's brutal. But I used to swim in Lake Tahoe growing up. That's at least as cold as this. May finished her wine and felt briefly aglow. She squinted into the sun, turned away, and saw a man in the distance on a silver sailboat, raising a tricolored flag.
How old are you?
The woman asked.
You look about 11.
24, May said.
My God, you don't have a mark on you. Were we ever 24, my love?
She turned to the man who was using a ballpoint pen to scratch the arch of his foot. He shrugged, and the woman let the matter drop.
Beautiful out here, May said. We agree,
the woman said.
The beauty is loud and constant. The sunrise this morning, it was so good. And tonight's a full moon. It's been rising full orange, turning silver as it climbs. The water will be soaked in gold and platinum. You should stay.
I have to return that, May said, indicating the kayak. She looked at her phone.
In about 8 minutes?
She stood up, and the man stood up and took her cup, setting his own cup inside hers.
"You think you can get back across the bay in 8 minutes?"
"I'll try," May said, and stood. The woman let out a loud tisk.
"I can't believe she's leaving already. I liked her."
"She's not dead, dear. She's still with us," the man said.
He helped May into the kayak and untied it.
"Be polite."
May dipped her hand into the bay and wet the back of her neck.
"Fly away, traitor,"
the woman said. The man rolled his eyes.
"Sorry."
"It's okay. Thanks for the wine," May said. "I'll come back again."
"That'd be swell,"
the woman said, though she seemed finished with May. It was as if, for a moment, she thought May was one kind of person, but now, knowing she was another, she could part with her. She could give her back to the world. May paddled toward the shore, her head feeling very light, the wine putting a crooked smile on her face, and only then did she realize how long she'd been free of thoughts of her parents, of Mercer, of the pressures at work. The wind picked up, now heading west, and she paddled with it recklessly, spray everywhere, soaking her legs and face and shoulders. She felt so strong, her muscles growing bolder with every splash of cold water. She loved it all. Seeing the free-range boats get closer, the caged yachts appear and take on names, and finally, the beach takes shape with Walt, waiting at the waterline. On Monday, when she got to work and logged on, there were 100 or so second-screen messages. From Annie,
"We missed you Friday night."
Jared,
"You missed a great bash."
Dan,
"Bummed you weren't at the Sunday celebration."
May searched her calendar and realized there had been a party on Friday, open to everyone in the Renaissance. Sunday had been a barbecue for newbies, the newbies that had arrived in the 2 weeks she'd been at the Circle.
"Busy day," Dan wrote. "See me ASAP."
He was standing in the corner of his office, facing the wall. She knocked lightly and, without turning, he raised his index finger, asking for a moment. May watched him, assuming he was on a call, and stood patiently, silently, until she realized he was using his retinals and wanted a blank background. She'd been seeing circlers occasionally doing this, facing walls so the images on their retinal displays could be seen more clearly. Now finished, he swirled to May, flashing a friendly and quick dissolving smile.
"You weren't able to come yesterday?"
"Sorry, I was with my folks. My dad,
great event. I think you were the only noob absent, but we can talk about it later. For now, I need to ask you a favor. We've had to bring on a lot of new help, given how fast things are expanding now, so I wondered if you could help me with some of the new arrivals."
"Of course."
"I think it'll be a cinch for you. Let me show you. We'll head back to your desk. Renata?"
Renata followed them, carrying a small monitor about the size of a notebook. She installed it at May's desk and left.
"Okay, so ideally you'll be doing what Jared used to do with you, remember? Whenever there's a stumper and it needs to be bounced up to a more seasoned person, you'll be there. You're the veteran now. Does that make sense?"
"It does."
"Now, the other thing is that I want the newbies to be able to ask you questions as they work. The easiest way will be on this screen."
He pointed to the small screen that had been placed under her main monitor.
"You see something appear here, you know it's from someone in your pod, okay?"
He turned on the new screen and typed out a question, "May help me," on his tablet. And the words appeared on this new fourth screen.
"Does that seem easy enough?"
"It does."
"Good. So the newbies will be here after Jared trains them. He's doing it en masse as we speak. There will be 12 new people here by about 11 a.m., okay?"
Dan thanked her and left. The load was heavy until 11, but her rating was 98. There were a handful of sub-100s and two lower 90s that she followed up on, and in most cases, the customers corrected their rating to 100. At 11, she looked up to see Jared leading a group into the room, all of them seeming very young, all of them stepping carefully, as if afraid to wake some unseen infant. Jared positioned each of them at a desk, and the room, which had been utterly empty for weeks, was nearly full in a matter of minutes. Jared stood on a chair.
"Okay, everyone," he said. "This is by far our quickest onboarding process and our quickest training session and our most maniacally fast first day, but I know you all can handle it.
and I especially know you can handle it because I'll be here all day to help, and May will be here too. May, can you stand up?
May stood, but it was obvious that few of the newbies in the room could see her.
How about standing on your chair?
Jared asked, and May did so, straightening her skirt, feeling very silly and visible and hoping she would not fall.
The two of us will be here all day to answer questions and take stumpers. If you have a stumper, just forward it, and it'll be routed to whichever of us has the lightest load. If you have a question, same thing. Send it through the channel I showed you in the orientation, and it'll go to one of us. Between me and May, you'll be covered. Everyone feel good?
No one moved or said a word.
Good. I'll open the chute again, and we'll go till 12:30 today. Lunch will be shorter today to account for the training and all, but we'll make it up to you on Friday. Everyone ready?
No one seemed ready.
Go!
And Jared jumped down, and May climbed down, arranged herself again, and was immediately 30 queries behind. She started on her first, and within a minute she had a question on her fourth screen, the one for newbies. Customer wants their entire payment record from last year. Available? And where? May directed the newbie to the right folder, then returned to the query in front of her. She continued this way, being pulled away from her own work every few minutes by a newbie question, until 12:30, when she saw Jared again, standing again on a chair.
Whoa, whoa, he said. That's lunch.
Intense. Intense, right?
But we did it. Our overall average is at 93, which is normally not so good, but okay considering the new systems and increased flow. Congratulations. Get some food, some fuel, and see you at 1 p.m. May, see me when you can?
He jumped down again and was at May's desk before she could get to his. His expression was one of friendly concern.
You haven't gone to the clinic.
Me?
Is that true?
I guess so.
You were supposed to have gone your first week.
Oh.
They're waiting. Can you go today?
Sure. Now?
No, we're too swamped right now, as you can see. How about at 4? I can handle the last shift. And by the afternoon, all of these newbies will be better honed. Did you have fun so far today?
Sure.
Stressed?
Well, it adds a new layer to things.
It does. It does. And there will be more layers, I want to assure you. I know someone like you would get bored of just the regular customer experience stuff, so next week we'll hook you up with a different aspect of the job. I think you'll love it.
He glanced at his bracelet and saw the time.
Oh, crap. You should go eat. I'm literally taking food out of your mouth. Go. You have 22 minutes.
May found a pre-made sandwich in the closest kitchen and ate at her desk. She scrolled through the third screen social feed, looking for anything urgent or needing a reply. She found and responded to 31 messages, feeling satisfied that she'd given careful attention to all those that required it. The afternoon was a runaway train, with the questions from the newbies constant, contrary to the assurances of Jared, who was in and out throughout the afternoon, leaving the room a dozen times, talking on his phone with great intensity. May dealt with the doubled flow, and by 3:48 had a personal score of 96. The pod's average was 94. Not bad, she thought, considering the addition of 12 new people and having to help them for much of 3 hours single-handedly. When 4 o'clock came around, she knew she was expected at the clinic and hoped Jared had remembered. She stood, found him looking her way, and he gave her a thumbs up. She left. The clinic's lobby was really not a lobby at all. It looked more like a cafe, with circlers talking in pairs, a wall of beautifully arrayed health foods and health drinks, and a salad bar featuring vegetables grown on campus, and a wall-mounted scroll featuring a recipe for paleo soup. May didn't know who to approach. There were 5 people in the room, 4 of them working on tablets, 1 fully retinal, standing in the corner. It was nothing like the standard window through which a medical administrative's face would have greeted her.
May?
She followed the voice to the face of a woman with short black hair, dimples in both cheeks, smiling at her.
You ready now?
May was led down a blue hallway and into a room that looked more like a designer kitchen than an examination room. The dimpled woman left her there, showing her to an overstuffed chair. May sat in it, then stood, drawn by the cabinets lining the walls. She could see horizontal lines as fine as thread, delineating where one drawer ended and the next began, but there were no knobs or handles. She ran her hand across the surface, barely registering the hairline gaps. Above the cabinets was a steel strip, and engraved in it were the words, "To heal, we must know. To know, we must share." The door opened, and May startled.
"Hi, May,"
a face said as it floated, gorgeous and smiling, toward her.
"I'm Dr. Villalobos."
May shook the doctor's hand, mouth agape. The woman was too glamorous for this room, for May. She was no more than 40, with a black ponytail and luminous skin. Elegant reading glasses hung from her neck, briefly followed the line of her cream-colored jacket, and rested on her ample chest. She was wearing 2-inch heels.
"I'm so glad to see you today, May."
May didn't know what to say. She arrived at, "Thanks for having me," and immediately felt like an idiot.
"No, thank you for coming," the doctor said. "We have everyone come in, usually in their first week, so we were getting worried about you. Is there any reason you delayed this long?"
"No, no, just busy." May scanned the doctor for physical flaws, finally finding a mole on her neck, a single tiny hair protruding from it.
"Too busy for your health? Don't say that."
The doctor had her back turned to May, preparing some kind of drink. She turned and smiled.
"So this is really just an introductory exam, a basic checkup we give to all new staff members here at the Circle, okay? And first of all, we're a prevention emphasis clinic. In the interest of keeping our Circlers healthy of mind and body, we provide wraparound wellness services. Does that square with what you've been told?"
"It does. I have a friend who's worked here for a couple years. She says the care is incredible."
"Well, that's nice to hear. Who's your friend?"
"Annie Allerton."
"Oh, that's right. That was in your intake. Who doesn't love Annie? Tell her hello. But I guess I can do that myself. She's in my rotation, so I see her every other week. She told you the checkups are biweekly."
"So that's..." The doctor smiled.
"Every 2 weeks. That's the wellness component. If you come here only when there's a problem, you never get ahead of things. The biweekly checkups involve diet consultations, and we monitor any variances in your overall health. This is key for early detection, for calibrating any meds you might be on, for seeing any problems a few miles away, as opposed to after they've run you over. Sound good?"
May thought of her dad, how late they'd realized his symptoms were MS.
"It does," she said. "And all the data we generate here is available to you online. Everything we do and talk about, and of course all your past records. You signed the form when you started that allowed us to bring in all your other doctor's information, so finally you'll have it all in one place, and it's accessible to you, to us. And we can make decisions, see patterns, see potential issues, given our access to the complete picture."
"You want to see it?" the doctor asked, and then activated a screen on the wall. May's entire medical history appeared before her in lists and images and icons. Dr. Villalobos touched the wall screen, opening folders and moving images, revealing the results of every medical visit she'd ever had, back to her first checkup before starting kindergarten.
"How's that knee?"
the doctor asked. She'd found the MRI May had done a few years ago. May had opted not to get ACL surgery. Her previous insurance didn't cover it.
"It's functional," May said.
"Well, if you want to take care of it, let me know. We do that here at the clinic. It would take an afternoon and, of course, would be free. The Circle likes its employees to have operational knees." The doctor turned from the screen to smile at May, practiced but convincing.
"Piecing together some of this stuff when you were very young was a challenge, but from here on out, we'll have near-complete information. Every 2 weeks, we'll do blood work, cognitive tests, reflexes, a quick eye exam, and a rotating retinue of more exotic tests, like MRIs and such."
May couldn't figure it out.
"But how is this affordable for you guys? I mean, the cost of an MRI alone..." "Well, prevention is cheap, especially compared to finding some stage 4 lump when we could have found it at stage 1. And the cost differential is profound. Because Circlers are generally young and healthy, our healthcare costs are a fraction of those at a similar-sized company, one without the same kind of foresight."
May had the feeling, which she was used to by now at the Circle, that they alone were able to think about,
or simply alone in being able to enact reforms that seemed beyond debate in their necessity and urgency. So when was your last checkup? Maybe college? Okay, wow. Let's start with your vital signs, all the basics. Have you seen one of these? The doctor held out a silver bracelet, about 3 inches wide. May had seen health monitors on Jared and Dan, but theirs were made of rubber and fit loosely. This one was thinner and lighter. I think so. It measures your heart rate? Right. Most of the long-term circulars have some version of it, but they've been complaining about it being too loose, like some kind of bangle, so we've modified it so it stays in place. You want to try it on? May did. The doctor fitted onto her left wrist and clicked it closed. It was snug. It's warm, May said. It'll feel warm for a few days. Then you and the bracelet will get used to each other. But it has to touch the skin, of course, to measure what we'd like to measure, which is everything. You did want the full program, right? I think so. In your intake, you said you wanted the complete recommended array of measurements. Is that still true? It is. Okay. Can you drink this? The doctor handed May the dense green liquid she'd been preparing. It's a smoothie. May drank it down. It was viscous and cold. Okay, you just ingested the sensor that will connect to your wrist monitor. It was in that glass. The doctor punched May's shoulder playfully. I love doing that. I already swallowed it, May said. It's the best way. If I put it in your hand, you'd ham and haw, but the sensor is so small and it's organic, of course, so you drink it, you don't notice, and it's over. So the sensor is already in me? It is. And now, the doctor said, tapping May's wrist monitor, now it's active. It'll collect data on your heart rate, blood pressure, cholesterol, heat flux, caloric intake, sleep duration, sleep quality, digestive efficiency, on and on. A nice thing for the circlers, especially those like you who might have occasionally stressful jobs, is that it measures galvanic skin response, which allows you to know when you're amped or anxious. When we see non-normative rates of stress in a circler or a department, we can make adjustments to workload, for example. It measures the pH level of your sweat, so you can tell when you need to hydrate with alkaline water. It detects your posture, so you know when you need to reposition yourself. Blood and tissue oxygen, your red blood cell count, and things like step count. As you know, doctors recommend about 10,000 steps a day, and this will show you how close you're getting. Actually, let's have you walk around the room. May saw the number 10,000 on her wrist, and with each step she took, it dropped. 9,999, 9,998, 9,997. We're asking all newbies to wear these second-gen models, and in a few months we'll have all circulars coordinated. The idea is that, with complete information, we can give better care. Incomplete information creates gaps in our knowledge, and medically speaking, gaps in our knowledge create mistakes and omissions. I know, May said. That was a problem in college for me. You self-reported your health data, and so it was all over the place. 3 kids died of meningitis before they realized how it was spreading. Dr. Villalobos's expression darkened. You know, that kind of thing is just unnecessary now. First of all, you can't expect college kids to self-report. It should all be done for them, so they can concentrate on their studies. STDs alone. Hep C. Imagine if the data was just there. Then appropriate action could be taken. No guesswork. Have you heard of that experiment up in Iceland? I think so, May said, but was only half sure. Well, because Iceland has this incredibly homogeneous population, most of the residents have roots many centuries back on the island. Anyone can trace their ancestry very easily back 1,000 years, so they started mapping the genomes of Icelanders, every single person, and were able to trace all kinds of diseases to their origins. They've gotten so much valuable data from that pool of people. There's nothing like a fixed and relatively homogeneous group exposed to the same factors. And a group you can study over time? The fixed group, the complete information, both were key in maximizing the takeaway. So the hope is to do something like that here. If we can track all you newbies and eventually all 10,000-plus circlers, we can both see problems far before they become serious, and we can collect data about the population as a whole. Most of you newbies are around the same age and in generally good health, even the engineers, she said, smiling at what was evidently a joke she often told. So when there are deviations, we'd like to know about them and see if there are trends we can learn from. Does that make sense? May was distracted by the bracelet. May? Yes, that sounds great. The bracelet was beautiful, a pulsing marquee of lights and charts and numbers. May's pulse was represented by a delicately rendered rose, opening and closing. There was an EKG shooting right like blue lightning and then starting over. Her temperature was rendered large in green, 98.6, reminding her of that day's aggregate, 97, which she needed to improve. "And what do these do?" she asked. There were a series of buttons and prompts, arranged in a row below the data. "Well, you can have the bracelet measure about 100 other things. If you run, it'll measure how far. It tracks your standing heart rate versus active. It'll measure BMI, caloric intake. See, you're getting it." May was busy experimenting. It was one of the more elegant objects she'd ever seen. There were dozens of layers to the information, every data point allowing her to ask more, to go deeper. When she tapped the digits of her current temperature, it could show the average temperature for the previous 24 hours, the high and the low, the median. "And of course," Dr. Villalobos said, "all that data is stored in the cloud and in your tablet, anywhere you want it. It's always accessible and is constantly updated. So if you fall, hit your head, you're in the ambulance, the EMTs can access everything about your history in seconds." "And this is free?" "Of course it's free. It's part of your health plan." "It's so pretty," May said. "Yeah, everyone loves it. So I should ask the rest of the standard questions. When was your last period?" May tried to remember. "About 10 days ago." "Are you sexually active?" "Not at the moment." "But in general?" "Generally, sure." "Are you taking birth control pills?" "Yes." "Okay. You can move that prescription over here. Talk to Tanya on your way out, and she'll give you some condoms for the things the pill can't prevent. Any other medications?" "Nope." "Antidepressants?" "Nope." "Would you say you're generally happy?" "I am." "Any allergies?" "Yes." "Oh, right. I have those here." "Horse is too bad." "Any family history of illness?" "Like at my age?" "Any age. Your parents? Their health is good?" Something about how the doctor asked the question, how she so clearly expected the answer to be yes, her stylus hovering above her tablet, knocked the wind out of May, and she couldn't speak. "Oh, honey," she said, and bringing her arm around May's shoulder and tilting her close, she smelled faintly floral. "There, there," she said, and May began to cry, her shoulders heaving, her nose and eyes flooding. She knew she was getting the doctor's cotton coat wet, but it felt like release and forgiveness. And May found herself telling Dr. Villalobos about her father's symptoms, his fatigue, his accident over the weekend. "Oh, May," the doctor said, stroking her hair. "May, May." May couldn't stop. She told Dr. Villalobos about his soul-flaying insurance situation, how her mother was expecting to spend the rest of her life caring for him, fighting for every treatment, hours on the phone every day with those people. "May," the doctor finally said, "have you asked HR about adding your parents to the company plan?" May looked up at her. "What?" "There are a handful of circlers who have family members like that on the insurance plan. I would imagine it's a possibility in your situation." May had never heard of such a thing. "You should ask HR," the doctor said. "Or actually, maybe you should just ask Annie." "Why didn't you tell me sooner?" Annie said that night. They were in Annie's office, a large white room with floor-to-ceiling windows and a pair of low couches. "I didn't know your parents had this insurance nightmare." May was looking at a wall of framed photos, each of them featuring a tree or shrub grown into a pornographic shape. "Last time I was here, you had only 6 or 7, right?" "I know. Word got out that I was some passionate collector, so now someone gives me one every day, and they're getting filthier all the time. See the one on top?" Annie pointed to a photo of an enormous phallic cactus. A copper-skinned face appeared in the doorway, her body hidden around the corner. "You need me?" "Of course I need you, Vicky," Annie said. "Don't go." "I was thinking of heading to the Sahara kickoff thing." "Vicky, don't leave me." Annie said, deadpan. I love you and don't want us to be apart. Vicky smiled, but seemed to be wondering when Annie would end this bit and let her go. Fine, Annie said. I should go too, but I can't. So go. Vicky's face disappeared. Do I know her? May asked. She's on my team, Annie said. There are 10 of us now, but Vicky's my go-to. You hear about this Sahara thing? I think so. May had read an Inner Circle notice about it, some plan to count the grains of sand in the Sahara. Sorry, we were talking about your dad? Annie said. I can't understand why you wouldn't tell me. May told her the truth, which was that she didn't see any scenario where her father's health would overlap with the Circle. There was no company in the country that covered an employee's parents or siblings. Sure, but you know what we say here, Annie said. Anything that makes our Circlers' lives better. She seemed to be waiting for May to finish the sentence. May had no idea. Instantly becomes possible. You should know that. Sorry. That was in your intake orientation, May. Okay, I'll get on this. Annie was typing something into her phone. Probably later tonight. I'm running into a meeting now, though. It's 6 o'clock. She checked her wrist. No, 6:30. This is early. I'll be here till 12, or maybe all night. We've got some very fun stuff happening. Her face was aglow, alive to possibility. Dealing with some juicy Russian tax stuff. Those guys do not fuck around. You sleeping in the dorms? Nah, I'll probably just push these two couches together. Oh, shit. I better go. Love you. Annie squeezed May and walked out of the room. May was alone in Annie's office, stunned. Was it possible that her father would soon have real coverage? That the cruel paradox of her parents' lives, that their constant battles with insurance companies actually diminished her father's health and prevented her mother from working, eliminating her ability to earn money to pay for his care, would end? May's phone buzzed. It was Annie. And don't worry, you know I'm a ninja with stuff like this. It'll be done. And she hung up. May looked out Annie's window to San Vincenzo, most of it built or renovated in the last few years. Restaurants to serve Circlers, hotels to serve visitors to the Circle, shops hoping to entice Circlers and their visitors, schools to serve children of the Circle. The Circle had taken over 50 buildings in the vicinity, transforming blighted warehouses into climbing gyms, schools, server farms, each structure bold, unprecedented, well beyond LEED. May's phone went off again, and again it was Annie. Okay, good news sooner than expected. I checked, and it's not a big deal. We have about a dozen other parents on the plan, and even some siblings. I twisted a few arms, and they say they can get your dad on. May looked at her phone. It had been 4 minutes since she'd first mentioned all this to Annie. Oh, shit. You're serious? You want your mom on the plan, too? Of course you do. She's healthier, so that's easy. We'll put both of them on. When? I guess immediately. I can't believe this. Come on, give me some credit, Annie said, breathless. She was walking briskly somewhere. This is easy. So should I tell my parents? What, you want me to tell them? No, I'm just making sure it's definite.